Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We now have a quorum. Representative Tice, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting, which was a long time ago?
Mr. Chair, I did read the minutes, and I moved that we accept them.
Representative Tice moves adoption of the minutes from yesterday's meeting. All those in favor of their adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tice. The minutes are approved. With that, we will jump right into it, and we're going to go to Representative... excuse me, it might be a long day of this. We're going to go with House File 2478. Excuse me, I will move House File 2478, and with that, Representative Albright, to you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is work comp bill. I have testifiers with me. I will plead ignorance on the details. Other than that, as always, Mr. Chair, when we come before this committee with substance on this matter, that we assure the committee members that there is peace in the valley.
Nicola for Davids.
Then I have a series of questions.
There are no new taxes in this, and it works for everyone. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to invite my testifiers to the table.
That is wonderful. Thank you, Representative Albright. Please identify yourself for the record and start with your testimony whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Liefeld, and I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today regarding House File 2478. Just to jump right into the bill is broken down into three articles. Article 1 relates and impacts the Work Comp Court of Appeals. Judge Patty Millen is present today. She is the Chief Judge of the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. These are mainly technical amendments in this article, including clarifying the two situations where the Work Comp Court of Appeals awards attorney fees and eliminates the bond requirement that the appellant pays a bond. A cost bond can still be required if a party requests one in extraordinary circumstances, but is no longer mandatory. This change will make the Work Comp Court of Appeals requirement consistent with the existing appellate court rule in non-workers' comp cases. Article 2 is identified as department proposals. The first change in Section 1 makes changes to the attachment standard for electronic transactions. This law, this attachment standard law was enacted last year and requires providers and insurers to use one standard electronic format to electronically transmit and receive relevant medical records or reports with the medical bill. Concern regarding this was brought to us by small and large providers in terms of implementation, and they needed more time. So the language is extending the implementation date out 6 months to January 1, 2017. And also we define more specifically what that attachment format is. Section 2 is housekeeping language that to accurately reflect the current state agency that administers workers' compensation claims of injured state workers, which is the Department of Administration and not the Department of Management and Budget. Finally, in Article 3, it's entitled Litigation-Related Proposals. And in large part, this relates to the work that takes place over at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The department worked closely with OAH, Office of Administrative Hearings, on this language. Just to go through it briefly, Section 1 is housekeeping amendment to definitions related to workers' compensation judges. Sections 2, 3, and 4 is really clarifying the language and making it current with the practice, which is amending the law governing remodeling of an injured worker's residence as needed to accommodate this disability. And it reflects, as I said, the current process for approval of a remodeling request by the three workers' compensation agencies, which is Labor and Industry, Office of Administrative Hearings, and the Work Comp Court of Appeals. Section 5, this amendment allows the comp judge to consider whether a good cause exists to grant a continuance of a hearing where a party has not timely filed an answer in response to a petition. Section 6 through 12 amends the statute governing intervention in workers' compensation disputes. This issue came up as a result of a Minnesota State Supreme Court decision, the Sumner decision, last July of 2015, which the court ruled that workers' compensation law requires interveners to be present at all scheduled conferences and hearing. In response to the decision, the Chief Administrative Law Judge issued a standing order allowing telephone attendance at hearings Unfortunately, it still proved to be a difficult task for interveners in light of multiple conferences and hearings being scheduled either at the same time or on the same day. So just to continue, 6, 7, and 8 sections makes terminology changes for consistency and clarity. Section 9 eliminates the current requirement that interveners must attend all pre-hearings and conferences unless a comp judge orders them to attend. Sections 10 and 11 allow interveners to file written responses and evidence in support of their claims according to procedures established by the Office of Administrative Hearings instead of attending a hearing in person. And finally, Section 12 grants the Chief Administrative Law Judge the authority to issue standing orders to implement the intervention statute in disputes before the Office of Administrative Hearings. That is my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Liefeld. I don't Thank see you. Any.
Mr. Chair?
Anybody else want to speak? Do you have any, Representative Albright, do you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, we're complete.
Okay. Does anybody else in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2478 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Albright. Since you're here, let's go right on with House File 2994.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will also move House File 2994 that it be passed and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Albright, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2994 is related to workers' compensation reinsurance, but also in this case, modifying the retention limits. And I also have two testifiers for this bill as well that I would like to call down to the testifier table at this time.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Come on down, whoever's coming to testify. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Herr. I'm the president and CEO for the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. The bill that you have before you, House File 2994, really has two primary changes. The first one would be to take the current indexing of our retentions to the state average weekly wage and remove that and have that be a decision that is made by the WCRA Board of Directors, subject to the approval of the Commissioner of the Labor and Industry, who is our primary regulator. The second change to the bill would, second change required by the bill would be adding one more retention option equal to 10 times our low retention, or approximately $5 million. Today there are three retention options of $500,000, $1 million, and $2 million. This would add one more option of $5 million. Currently half of our membership selects the super retention, which is the $2 million option. This would give them one more choice among that matter. This bill would have no impact to the benefits that are offered to the injured workers of the state. It in no way affects that. That is a statutory 176. This is strictly a financial transaction and risk transfer between the insurers and self-insurers of the state and the WCRA. Ultimately, who supports the bill? There is no known opposition to the bill at this time. We have
That's our favorite kind of bill.
Yes. Thank you. The WCRA board has passed this unanimously. The Work Comp Advisory Council has unanimously passed the bill. You also find in your packets a joint letter between the AFL-CIO and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supporting this bill as well. And we have support from our member groups, the Insurance Federation and the Self-Insurer Alliance.
Thank you, Mr. Herr. Members, any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herr, just out of curiosity, so what are the type of employers that then would be moving into the jumbo coverage versus the super coverage? If you could just sort of reiterate that, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Herr.
Representative Dean. The currently, it would be most likely the largest either self-insurers or the largest insurers in the state. There is no restriction on what retention a given entity can select. It would be based on if you're a self-insurer, whether you can support the bond that would be needed for that $5 million retention. That would also have to be approved by the Department of Commerce in terms of, as a self-insurer, they regulate that. For the insurance carriers, it would really come down to do they have the financial wherewithal to do that, how would it affect their ratings and their ability to pay claims.
Representative Dean? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Herr. Representative Albright, did you say you had another testifier?
I do not. I thought there was an accompaniment.
No, that's fine. I think we're convinced. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody. I will renew my motion that House File 2994, House File 2994 be passed and re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Albright. Thank you,
members. Thank you very much.
Since I don't see Representative Swiedzinski, let's go on to Representative Sanders. And while he's coming down, Will and Nick are two pages. Gentlemen, thank you. We Chair Kelly runs sort of a slipshod committee, and they went past their time. And so we had to do a little scrambling here to get everything ready. So thank you very much for your efforts, as well as everybody else. So with that, Representative Sanders, if you want to move your bill, House File 3281.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, I don't know what's the next destination. This is General Register. Yes.
General Register, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have House File 3281 to be referred to the General Register.
Thank you. And with that, if you want to talk a little bit about the bill or just introduce our celebrity guests, whatever is your preference.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll just briefly say that this is basically a technical cleanup bill. We're just adding raffle boards, which is a previously approved game or method that was approved back in the 2015 session. This bill is not considered to be controversial. The charitable gaming industry, Department of Revenue, Department of Public Safety, and the Gambling Control Board all support this bill. And I'll introduce Mr. Barrett and let him walk through anything else more technical or answer any questions.
Mr. Barrett, welcome back to the committee. Please start when you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board. And again, I thank Representative Sanders on this bill. He was actually the original author last year that provided a bill that benefited charitable gaming. The provisions in this bill before you simply add the raffle board, a legal form of charitable gaming, to the provisions in law that pertain to people that shouldn't have raffle boards. So it's simply in the various sections, I can certainly go through section by section, but if you're not authorized to have the boards, that means revenue can tax you if you're found to have them, and public safety can go after you criminally if you have those boards in your possession. So what this simply does is complement the bill that was passed, the allowance last year for raffle boards, but drives home the criminal and tax penalties if the wrong persons have them in their possession.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Members, any questions?
I got a couple.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Barrett, do your folks have to undergo background checks? I'll withdraw that one. I'll talk to you.
Since they're a gambling entity, yes, they do.
I'm good.
Any other questions? Anybody else that wants to come and testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Sanders, do you want the final word?
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 3281 be passed and re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
That was overwhelming. those opposed, same sign.
We feel very
motion tough. Prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders and members. That is on its way to the General Register. Representative Swiedzinski.
I thought we laid that bill over, Mr. Chairman.
No, we're about to.
I'm a little slow.
Representative Swiedzinski, if you want to go ahead and move your bill so it is properly
yes.
before us, I believe its destination is the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hoppe. Thank you, Commerce Committee members. I move House File 3102 to be moved to the General Register.
And we have an amendment here. Is this Representative Swiedzinski? I assume this is an author's amendment?
Yes, it is.
Why don't you go ahead and move the 0870 amendment so that we get the bill in the shape you'd like it to be in?
Yes, I'd like to move the 0870 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it.
Representative Swiedzinski moves the 0870 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Swedzinski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then again, this bill has largely been in front of this committee as of last year. We do have a few changes and differences from the bill that was before us. I do have Al Lund to speak to some of those slight changes and to go over the bill. So thank you.
Mr. Lund, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Al Lund from the Allied Charities of Minnesota. And the bill, five of the sections deal with an electronic raffle selection device. There would be another option for charities that conduct raffles that would allow them to have that number picked electronically. Currently, all of the stubs from a raffle need to go into a barrel bucket where then they're hand-drawn. This would allow for a random number generator to select that number, and typically would be used in large settings like the Minnesota Twins, St. Paul Saints, when they're conducting their 50-50 raffles. Also allows us, a gambling manager today needs to have served with an organization for 6 months. That's going to drop down to 90 days. Will help us recruit gambling managers and keep the charities in business. Modifying what a hotball bingo prize is. The hotball bingo prize today can only be funded by the organization, and with this change, the players would, with the proceeds, would be able to fund it. But if it is funded by players, there would need to be a different colored paper, so the Gambling Control Board would be able to easily identify if they were using the right paper or not. So, which we believe is a good thing. Documentation of employees. The some bingo session changes. We're raising the limits on cover-all games, single games, and then no aggregate on session limits. And then the acknowledgement from the cities that collect 10% of our net proceeds, that they would have to acknowledge publicly that they receive that money from charitable gambling and which organization they receive that from.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author or to Mr. Lund. On the A16 amendment, we just deleted the section that required a gambling manager. So the clause that you referred to in Section 3, is that just if people want to do that?
Mr. Lund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, yes. So the issue with the 8 that was just removed here was there was an option for, there would have been an option to have a interim gambling manager. And in talking to charities and to the Gambling Control Board, we did feel that there was enough protection at this point that if a gambling manager were to fall ill or, God forbid, drop dead tomorrow, that the Gambling Control Board would work diligently to make sure that that organization would have the time to get someone up to speed. So, and this would help. Today, you would not have to be a member for 6 months. We'll make it 90 days, so you would be able to assume that role quicker if you came into an organization.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on another note, so I'm assuming if we move to these random number generators, that they'll also then be monitoring and regulating or specific things relative to what type of random number generators they're going to use in these type of 50-50 raffles, because not all number generators are the same.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, so today we currently have authority to use a random number generator in the tri-wheel tool that we have in our electronic pull tabs and with the electronic link bingo. So it would have to be in a format that's approved by the Gambling Control Board. So very thorough examination of the tool.
Any other questions? I don't want this to end. I'm just going to sit here for a while. Unless there's any other questions, Representative Swedzinski, anything further you want to add?
I renew my motion.
Attaboy. All right. Well, Representative Swedzinski has renewed his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion passes. Thank you. Mr. Lund, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Next up is our motion to make me permanent chair of the House Commerce Committee. All in favor say aye.
That's just hurtful.
Representative Oppy, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Where are we going with this?
Civil law, I believe, Mr. Chair.
Moves House File 3384 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Always a fun place to go.
Yeah.
Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. And Civil Law is my second favorite committee. So Representative Scott wasn't listening, but it is my second favorite committee. So, Mr. Chair and members, this is House File 3384, and this is known as the, excuse me, I might make it through this, the PBR bill, the Principal-Based Reserves. I have a very brief statement, and then I will turn it over to my celebrity testifier. Members, as way a little background here, life insurers set aside capital reserves to ensure that they will be able to pay all future expected claims. The current system for calculating reserves dates back to the Civil War. That's the American Civil War, not the English one. It utilizes a formulaic one-size-fits-all approach. This inflexible, outdated approach locks in certain assumptions that do not allow for changes in economic conditions, more modern product features, interest rate fluctuations, or insurer experience. In response, over the past decade, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, in conjunction with the American Academy of Actuaries, developed the Principal-Based Reserve System. The NAIC's new PBR framework calculates reserve based on a set of fundamental principles rather than a one-size-fits-all formula, and right-sizes reserves by reducing reserves that are too high for some products and increases reserves that are too low for others. PBR also strengthens the solvency oversight of regulators by providing them with tools to properly monitor a life insurer's reserve levels through annual reporting and review. The bill before you, House File 3384, is NAIC model language with a couple of tweaks in it, amending the standard non-forfeiture law and the standard valuation law to implement PBR in Minnesota. PBR becomes operational in the United States once it has been adopted in at least 42 U.S. jurisdictions, which are accounting for 75% of U.S. life insurance premiums. As of March 20, 2016, there were 40 states that have adopted the necessary legislation, with three states, Washington, Utah, and South Carolina, that are awaiting their governor's final action. Once these governors sign this legislation, the 42-state and 75% total premium threshold will have been attained. This will mean that PBR will be operational starting January 1st of next year, so January 1st of 2017. PBR legislation is also moving in three other states and is expected to move in two others, which would, if my math is right, be darn near 50. PBR is supported by the NAIC and the Academy of Actuaries. It is also supported by a leading consumer advocate, Bernie Birnbaum, whom I heard speak about PBR at the most recent NCOIL meeting that I attended. This is the same consumer advocate the Department of Commerce brought to Minnesota, to support one of their proposals in the Senate Commerce Committee last week. In the interest of full disclosure, and I'm sure he'll be up here to share this with you, Commissioner Rothman has told me that he does not, at least at this time, support PBR. My hope is that we can talk about this bill today, move it on to civil law, and let the various parties on the one side meet with the Department of Commerce and come to something that is acceptable to the commissioner so we can do what a number of other states have already done. And lastly, Commissioner Rothman isn't supporting. I think it's fair to say, and I don't want to speak for him, I don't think he's looking for this to pass this year. I'm worried about our Minnesota-based life insurance companies being left behind their competitors and all the other states that do pass this, which is going to be the new national standard. We do not want to leave our companies at a competitive disadvantage. With that, I have probably testified more than I ever have on one bill, and I will turn it over to the lovely and talented Ms. Rowan.
I can write that.
Ms. Rowan, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, known as MIFC. MIFC members offer life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, and retirement savings products to Minnesotans. And we support over 55,000 jobs in Minnesota, including all the agents and financial advisors that are in every corner of the state. You may or may not remember, but I've been before this committee several times talking about STOLE, and now I'm here talking about PBR. So I just want to be clear that I'm not talking about the liquor bill. I'm actually talking about insurance, although you guys may need a drink after we're done with this. So it might all be related anyway.
Aye.
As Chair Hoppe indicated, our Minnesota-based companies believe it's critically important to enact PBR this year. Minnesota doesn't adopt PBR during the legislative session, as of 1/1/17, Minnesota-based life insurers will be at a competitive disadvantage. And this is why. Term life insurance reserves under the current formulas are very conservative and onerous, which results in higher prices to consumers and trapped capital for insurers. Beginning on 1/1/17, competing life insurers in states that have adopted PBR will be able to offer consumers life insurance at term life insurance at lower prices. And Minnesota consumers will be paying more for similar products that consumers in other states are paying less for. And term life is a product that's bought most frequently by middle class and military families. The commissioner has said that PBR isn't ready for prime time. But this seems to be contrary to the position of the vast majority of the states, the NAIC, and the Academy of Actuaries. There could be as many as 48 states that have PBR in place by the end of the year. There is only one other state that is opposed to PBR, and not a single regulator has testified against it in a single state. PBR applies only to new business, meaning it will take effect gradually, and it doesn't change reserves for existing blocks of business. PBR will be subject to annual stress tests, and the commissioner can order insurers to increase reserves if required. The model language in front of you sets up a framework that can be adjusted by regulators quickly to respond to changes in the economy, insurer experience, or other factors impacting reserves. We have been puzzled by the department's reluctance to support this widely adopted model and to work with us to implement it here in Minnesota. We originally understood that it might be a resource issue, and we offered to help them secure funding to make sure we are properly staffed, because obviously we want we're very supportive of a well-staffed department.
I'm not going either.
This is really important to our hometown companies. You have a letter in your packet signed by domestic company CEOs that feel that they will be negatively impacted if we don't do PBR this year. And CEOs don't lend their signatures to letters very often, and certainly give a lot of thought to doing so in the case where their regulator is taking the opposite position, but it's a testament to how strongly we feel about it. I also want to call your attention to something else that's in your packets. You should have a snapshot. And what this shows you is that 40 states have enacted PBR so far. There are six more that are considering it. Three of these are already on the governor's desk: South Carolina, Washington, and Utah, Alabama, and Massachusetts. It's moving in both those. Neither Alaska or DC, where it may or may not move this year, have domestic life insurance companies, so it's not as big an impact.
Yeah.
Wyoming has some sort of funky procedural issue, so they couldn't do it this year,
Puerto Rico.
Which leaves us to the last category. And I know yesterday Chair Hoppe mentioned that this committee might be a spring break destination of sorts, and he might be onto something, because we are in the same category as Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and the Virgin Islands, and New York, if we don't pass PBR. So I would be happy to answer questions, and I very much appreciate your support.
Are there any outstanding former chairman of the Commerce Committee with questions?
Oh.
Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Hoppe, Chairman Hoppe, for bringing this bill forward. This is in my category of no-brainers. You've got 48 states that will have this. And so I have a question for Ms. Rowan. Okay, so we don't pass this for some weird reason, some odd reason, which I can't fathom. But let's just say we don't come on board here and do the right thing. And so our domestic companies, okay, so Iowa has done this.
Mm-hmm.
So Principal Group, EMC National Life, United Life, they can sell term at a more competitive rate. Would that term policy be for sale in Minnesota? Ms. Rohn?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, no.
So,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Rowan. So if we don't do this, if I can get a good rate from Principal Financial Group, which is based in Des Moines, Iowa, they can't sell that policy in Minnesota? Is that what we're saying?
Ms. Rowan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, correct.
Representative Davids?
Well, that's pure insanity. So our consumers are going to be hurt, financially hurt, because we didn't get on board and do the right thing. Is that what we're saying here? This makes no sense to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, that's correct. You would not be able to sell term life insurance in Minnesota at the lower rates, because you wouldn't be able to use the lower reserves.
Well, see, I get paid on commission, Mr. Chairman. That No. I was just thinking through that a little bit. So Ameriprise, Minnesota Life, Securian, Allianz, Thrivent, all domestic carriers could not give better rates to Minnesotans because our department isn't on board here? Is that what we're saying?
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, yes, that's my understanding. And can I... did this not get in?
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Rowan referenced the letter, and the whole letter is here. The back page where the signatures are didn't get copied on there, so I'll just read those if that's okay with the Chair.
Please.
Brad Hewitt, the President and CEO of Thrivent Financial. Christopher Hilger, the President and CEO of Securian Financial. Michael Smith, the CEO of Insurance Solutions at Voya Financial. And John Stenberg, the Executive Vice President and General Manager, RiverSource Life Insurance Company, Ameriprise. So those are the signatures of the CEOs that should have been included on that letter. My apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a few questions. So we talk about how Minnesota consumers are going to benefit from this change. Can you talk to us about what that type of benefit might actually look like?
Is that to Ms. Rowan or Chairman Hoppe?
Well, whoever has the knowledge, I guess.
Well, Ms. Rowan. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Here's your gavel back, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, my understanding is that if you aren't able to use the lower reserves, you aren't able to offer a lower price. And so they wouldn't be able to buy term life at a more competitive price. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, it kind of does, but are we talking a magnitude of 2% reduction in the premium I'm paying or a magnitude of 12 or 14% reduction in the premium that I'm paying?
Ms. Brown?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm not an actuary. I don't pretend to be. I didn't even take tax law in law school because I thought there might be an outside chance it would have math in it. But my understanding is that it could be double-digit decreases in terms of premium.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more questions. So, Chair Hoppe, when you sort of presented the bill, you said there were a few tweaks from the model, and I'm assuming if the goal is to get, 42 states or whatever to pass this, are those then 42 states going to have to pass the tweaks as well, or is this really just sort of an industry agreed upon process?
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, what I'm hoping is that we pass this bill today, and on its way between the time it leaves here and the time it arrives in civil law, Ms. Rowan gets to meet with the Department of Commerce and fixes those to their satisfaction. The other states, to my knowledge, haven't done those or haven't done, so I'll let Ms. Rowan speak to that. But what I'm hoping is that we get this passed to the department's satisfaction and that we can pass it this year. We're not going to pass anything if they don't like it, so I hope that we can get everybody together and get it worked out.
Representative Dean, anything further at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the only tweaks that are still in our version are places where the NAIC model language said to insert Minnesota law, and we did the best that we could. The department wasn't available, interested in meeting with us on that, and so we did the best we could in filling those tweaks. But those are the only things that are there. There was originally, I think the department was concerned about something called the small company exemption, but it was decided by the NAIC that that small company exemption should be in the valuation manual and not in the law itself, and so we took that out.
Representative.
And my last question, and this is, thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Hoppe. So are the NCOIL conferences worth attending?
Chairman Hoppe, you want to try?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Davids has been there. Mr. Brickwitty was there with the last one, and I. Not only are they worth attending, I think I'm trying to get, and Chair Atkins has tried to get Minnesota to be a member of NCOIL again. We haven't been for probably 15 years, something like that. But it's with the number of Minnesota-based insurance companies that we have, they are good. When you're listening to a bunch of senators from other states talk about literally whether they should have a colon or a semicolon in their white paper, it drives you a little bit crazy, but it really is good stuff. I know Commissioner Rothman and others go to the NAIC meetings, and with the number of insurance companies we have here, I think it's beneficial for, and I'd like to see a bipartisan bicameral delegation go. I'd also like the NCOIL to include more staff representation there from both the House and the Senate. Now, I think they're very worthwhile.
Okay. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Rowan? We do have two testifiers, Commissioner Rothman and Mr. Anderson from the department. Gentlemen, thank you for your patience. Commissioner, welcome back. Do you want to? Are you going to kick things off, or are you going to look to our actuarial friends first? But
I'll start. You have the dynamic duo with you today, so we really appreciate the opportunity to present our candid and honest perspective on this piece of legislation. It's good to see you back in the chair. And at the same
time, I'm kind of liking it myself.
And at the same time, I also want to say that I truly do appreciate working with Representative Hoppe. He and I had a conversation last week about this bill and our perspective. So let me just cut to the chase and tell you why the department is where it is in terms of our position on the legislation. So thank you. Again, I'm joined with me today but with Fred Anderson. He's the chief insurance deputy and the chief life actuary for the department. Fred has been involved with the development of principle-based reserving, PBR, from the start, which is more than a decade ago. He's recognized in the nation as one of the leading experts in life actuarial science, and we're just pleased to have him here with us in Minnesota. And then, as you know, I have insurance insolvency experience going back to the early 1990s, including working on two of the largest insurance insolvencies in U.S. history, including the one that was the biggest life insurance insolvency. So to get the department's position, let me give you the PBR background at a very high level. Overall, PBR is meant to address statutory reserving under existing law and replace it with principle-based reserving, which is risk-based an approach. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, back before I even started in 2011, but in 2011, was working on what's known as the valuation manual. It's been in development. And at the same work, the framework has called for two tracks. We'll start getting the valuation manual developed with our actuaries, both industry and regulatory, and set up a process for the adoption of laws by the states. Candidly, Minnesota has been cautious about where PBR is going because we want to make sure it's done right before it's implemented. The goal of the NAIC has been to try to adopt it by 2017 by all the states with a three-year implementation. So, but the law is written so that if it wasn't adopted by enough states by a certain time, it wouldn't kick in until the following year, and then additional 3 years after that for implementation. There's plenty of time to get this right. Recently, problems have come up with the manual that's basically the engine for this thing. Just to put it straightforward, the Commerce Department's serious concerns about the legislation can be summarized very simply as this. I believe prudence and caution dictates that we get the valuation manual fixed. Let's not put it on the streets before it's wrong, before it's not fixed. And Minnesota shouldn't adopt PBR as law until it is fixed correctly. Right now, I'll get into why it's not correctly fixed, but I have said, and I've been candid and forthright ever since 2011, that Minnesota would be, I'd be in a position to recommend and suggest PBR for Minnesota so long as we get it right. And I even had a conference call with the CEOs and the representatives and MFC, Robbins Group, to explain the department's position, which is simply this, that PBR is not ready for prime time nationally. It's not ready for prime time in Minnesota. We shouldn't adopt the law until 2017. It shouldn't the bottom line is that right now the Life Actuary Task Force at the NAIC is trying to fix these issues. And we're going to, I'll talk a little bit about why it's broken and why it's not ready for prime time. I also want to be clear about what's at stake. Fundamentally, this is about ensuring the long-term solvency of life insurance companies and protecting consumers who trust that these companies will have the financial reserves to fulfill their obligations, paying the claims and benefits promised in the years ahead. The current issues being worked on by the NAIC's task force have much greater potential impact on life insurance companies' reserves than many other PBR-related issues that have been discussed over the last few years. If the NAIC task force takes action, it will likely not occur, or it's going to come up in the summer, it's going to come up at the NAIC in 2 weeks, and there will be further discussion, but it will not likely get fixed until later the summer or later. The prudent thing to do at this time is to wait for the task force to finish its work. Once the task force succeeds in correcting the valuation manual, assuming it's done this year, the department believes PBR would be ready for legislation next year. I've even said, Model Acts in Minnesota are typically carried as a department bill by the department when they're ready. This is one I've said we'd be willing to do when it's ready, and I've said that to all of the companies. And we'd be very willing to work and continue to work with industry and other interest parties to get it right. I've also said a clean version of this bill plus the resources the department needs is critical for correct implementation of the legislation. Now, as the agency responsible for regulating insurance companies doing business in Minnesota, the Commerce Department has a fundamental duty to safeguard the long-term solvency of life insurance companies and protect the consumers. Solvency is precisely the critical issue currently before the NAIC task force for the entire country. After many states adopted the NAIC model law, which has been described to you previously in the chart, the valuation manual was amended in a way that lowered the reserves on term life insurance by as much as 60%. Now, the actuaries currently are very concerned about that. The department is concerned about that. Other departments around the country are concerned about that, and the NAIC will be looking at this issue very seriously in the coming weeks ahead. Now, I want to make myself clear about this. The 60% is an average based of the modeling that's going on. That means that some of the modeling is predicting a near zero percentage in terms of the reserves on term life insurance. So yes, as Robin indicated, military families, you, consumers, anybody who sells term life insurance, all of us need to be concerned that the NAIC, the actuaries in the industry, the department, the regulatory actuaries get this right. The manual has potentially jeopardizing the solvency of the companies across the United States is a significant issue to me, even though PBR would only be effective for new business going forward. So if you have business in place, the current statute as written, the way it works is that those reserves would stay in place that have been set up. But the decrease in reserves after 5 years is estimated, and these are big numbers, these are very big numbers, Mr. Chair, are estimated to be over $10 billion. And after 10 years, it could be over $100 billion in under-reserving or the dropping of reserves. Now, it's much better, and typically, at least from the regulatory perspective and the NAIC's view, is that we should not move forward with these kinds of reserve problems across the country until we get it right. I want to be candid and straightforward. I've been straightforward with the regulators across the country since 2011 and to the insurance companies about my position of being cautious. But once those reserves are gone, they would be gone. They're poof. You don't get them back. And once that money is gone, it's not coming back into the companies. The substantial reduction in reserves under PBR is based on factors where there is great uncertainty, including assumptions about how many policyholders will lapse their policies after substantial rate increases. It highlights the need for the task force to show that it is able to evaluate and address PBR issues that are critical to ensure solvency. It is important that reserves on long-term products be based on conservative financial rules in order to ensure that insurance companies will be able to fulfill their obligations and pay their claims to consumers. Now, I want to address the issue of competitiveness because I have been clear about this, and I've talked to the companies. I do not want to see any of our companies disadvantaged. They won't be. My perspective is that this shouldn't be adopted this year. It should be adopted next year. We have 3 years to implement it. There's plenty of time to do that. In fact, some of the companies have already started working on PBR modeling. We've worked, Fred and others are working with the companies on these things. And based on these discussions and the current regulatory competitive landscape, we believe that adopting PBR even now is not a decision that needs to be made this year. In getting to one of the questions asked earlier, that's simply not true. I think, Representative Davids, you asked the question about the companies that they used. I'm going to have Fred, the actuary, talk about these questions. But companies that, you know, might be able to lower their reserves because of what happens in other states they're able to sell those. It's not like they're prevented from doing so at the border. Fundamentally, it's important that we get this right. The Commerce Department does need to have the additional actuarial resources to review PBR filings from insurers and accurately evaluate the impact of solvency calculations. We want to be at the speed of the marketplace. It's a very important thing. And because of the uncertainty surrounding the impact of the model, the Commerce Department does not support acting on PBR this legislative session. I've committed to maintaining an open dialogue on PBR, speaking with everybody. And to further understand the implementation of the PBR model, I want to make sure folks do understand we are in an open dialogue. We're working very hard to make sure that PBR is fixed and corrected, right? The department will be involved with 6 other states in a pilot program during the next year. There's 5 or 6 other states that are the ones that are piloting some of the biggest issues. And it's not like, as characterized earlier, we're not involved in the process and we just aren't going to be involved and that's our position. That's absolutely not true. You know, based on this, the Commerce Department's goal will be to bring a clean version of the Model Act, as we would normally, forward during the 2017 legislative session that reflects both the appropriate NEIC corrections and adequate staffing resources for the agency. Again, I believe the prudent thing to do at this time, both for the industry and for consumers, is to allow the NEIC task force to do its work through this year. If the task force succeeds in addressing concerns about the valuation manual, then we will be in a position for legislation next year that works for industry, works for all, and works for consumers. As folks have said, I believe it's not ready for prime time in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time. Fred is here, and we're happy to answer. Let me just say a couple other things. The actuaries who have developed, who actually initially developed PBR, are now the ones who are highly concerned about it. That's the other issue that was addressed about our not being in a competitive disadvantage is would only happen if we don't pass PBR in Minnesota. That's not our position. Our position is that this should happen next year, and there's plenty of time to get it right. I would liken it to this. It would be like a major manufacturer of a car or an engine or even a brake system, that before you put it onto the street and harm folks and you let it out of the gates, the engine needs to be fixed, the car needs to be fixed before it does damage to the economy. And that's our position, and we're going to work hard on it and do everything we can. But I don't know if you wanted to address anything else.
I think there might be a couple questions before
any
we get to Mr. Anderson. I've got a couple. I see Representative Davids and Sanders had a couple. My first one is just a very basic one, and that is, in light of what you said, could we adopt the legislation authorizing PBR but delay the implementation until, and I'm going to look to Chairman Hoppe because he's...
Mr. Chair, to that point,
yes,
I was going to bring up the same thing. If you look at page 1 of the bill, line 1.8, that says that this does not take effect until the January 1st of the calendar year after the valuation manual has been approved.
Commissioner, you want to comment with respect to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Fred answer as well, too. I've even talked to at least, you know, some other regulators that have said, look, it's a reasonable position to be prudent and cautious before passing the law to make sure that the valuation manual is fixed. The bottom line is that that manual needs to be fixed. And there's been pressures. I'm going to be candid and honest about this. When the issues have come up, there's a lot of companies, there's a lot of regulators that are going back and forth and trying to fix the manual. It may not get fixed this year. That assumes that it does. And so from our perspective is that we need to make sure that the valuation manual is fixed before we adopt the law. Once we even bring it back next session, there's plenty of time. There's the 3 years after that for implementation. And there's no need to be in such a rush. We won't be at a competitive disadvantage. I don't see the reasons for it or the need for it at this time.
Okay. I was just making the analogy of, you know, using your car example, that we would, you know, before any of the vehicles leave the shop, that the engine would be fixed. And that, you know, it wouldn't go into effect until January 1 of the year after we know that the engine's fixed.
Mr. Chair, may I just be candid about this?
Please.
No, you can't.
If
no, we'd rather than no, not be, if, don't be candid.
If all the other states get it wrong, I don't want Minnesota to be the subject of something that wasn't done correctly.
Okay. So thank you with respect to that. Just a couple other quick ones. In other states, you indicated that insurance companies had lowered their reserves by as much as 60%. Begs the question, was that because the reserves were 60% too high to begin with?
Let me clarify. I'm going to turn over to Fred.
Okay.
That's modeling. What I was referring to is the valuation manual was recently amended with updates. And when they did the modeling on the valuation manual, the estimates are that the reserves would drop 60% under the modeling. PBR was... So, in effect, if the law had been effective 2016, that would have been what would have happened in 2016. The insurance commissioners overall have been very cautious about this. They want to make sure it's fixed. And I turn to Fred because he's been the one working with the actuaries on the modeling.
Okay.
Mr. Anderson. Hi.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. The key regarding the 60% is that for, I'd say, 9.5 years, everybody involved with PBR was under the impression that reserves would go down about 30 to 35%. And just about 6 months ago, and this is after a vast majority of the states adopted PBR legislation, a change to the valuation manual was made such that the change would no longer be 30-35%, it would be a 60% reduction. And so all the people like me who have been involved with PBR from the start, we're the ones who are scared right now about what did we just create. And so we're, I think in the past week we've had 6 or 7 hours worth of calls to try to rapidly as possible fix it. And we're having a public meeting a week from, or it's on April 1st, where a lot of this information is going to come out that might even make it look like it would be worse than reserves going down 60%, and in many cases might go down more than 60% the way the valuation manual is now. So there's great concern by the actuaries who develop PBR about what's happened in the past 6 months.
Thank you. And Ms. Rowan or Chairman Hoppe, did you... Chairman Hoppe.
I'll talk and then she can straighten out what I said. But Mr. Chair, and I have great respect for that, in the bill it says this doesn't become law until that gets fixed. This doesn't work at all. This doesn't become law until the valuation book and the NEIC model is done.
But Chairman Hoppe isn't, and Commissioner, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but who's driving that train is my question. If it's adopted at the NEIC level and they all like it and it's wrong, and our folks here at the Department of Commerce think it's wrong, are we forcing their hand and making them put it in place?
Right.
In spite of, and with that, I would, the next question that I had, and then I'll relent.
But there was a point, I believe, that Ms. Rowan made about you can, at the department level, change the reserve level if actuarial reviews show that it's necessary, and that you can do it relatively rapidly, and you can do it here in this state. Is that an accurate, whether it's accurate or not, is that your understanding, what power you would have under this bill? Mr. Anderson.
Okay, I don't know about the fact that it can be done in a speedy manner, because this methodology is going to be a lot more complicated than the current methodology, and we're not going to be able to review it all at once. It's going to be more on a targeted basis. And so, I mean, my findings over, I've been doing this for about 18 years, is that it's a lot easier to have reserves be a little too high and then bring them down a little bit than for them to be too low and then bring them up.
Not true.
So my concern is that, you know, if companies are allowed to use, you know, the 60% decrease methodology, you know, by the time, I think we eventually would fix it. It's just at a state level. But again, it's so important to get it done at the national level, because if we fix it in Minnesota, because, you know, we have people looking at it, but in many other states they're not looking at it, we're going to be looking at the competitive disadvantage aspect again, where some states are going to ignore the fact that reserves went down 60 or 70% inappropriately, where we're going to care about it and say, no, you need to bring it back up to the 30 to 35% spot. And so, you know, I just think it's so important to get this right at the national level that it would just make, you know, everything easier nationwide.
And folks, thank you for your tolerance for my apologies for monopolizing the questions for a little while there. But Representative Davids, and then Representative Sanders, Dean, and Lunan are on the list. So Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel like right now I'm in an alternative universe. I can't believe what's happening here. Okay, how many times have we heard we need to be prudent, cautious, and candid? Okay, if we need to be prudent, cautious, and candid, are we saying that 46 states were not prudent, cautious, and candid?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Hoppe, my perspective has been, and I've been straightforward with all the other insurance commissioners, that we all want to be prudent, cautious. I don't want to speak for them, but I would say that we all do want to be cautious. This is so important to get it right in the United States on a solvency's perspective, that it's creating, and it will be a very significant issue that's being debated. But I just want to clarify that what happened was the valuation manual was developed. The state started passing the law. It was on the implementation phase. But after those states passed the law, then it was amended. And it was the amendment of the valuation law that's the problem. That's the issue right here. So it's not, we're not trying to characterize anybody else in this point. All we're saying is, from our perspective in Minnesota, I will be talking to the other commissioners. I've already talked to one, that the prudent and cautious approach here is to make sure that LATIF, the Life Actuarial Task Force, fixed the valuation manual.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things that I take, I just need to clarify. We're talking about reserves going down, say, 60%. If any company, not the department, but if any company sees that their reserves are too low, they will immediately pump money in to bring the reserves up. They're not going to let them be low, because the Commerce Department, believe it or not, is not the only entity in the world. There's something called AM Best, Standard & Poor's, and others. And they are not going to give up their A-plus rating or their A rating or their A-minus rating for anything. If they see their reserves are too low, they're going to pump however what much they need to put in there immediately. So to talk to the committee and say, oh, if the reserves go too low, they'll never come back up, you know, Armageddon. No, that's not how it works. They're going to keep their A-plus or their A ratings. They're not going to let them slide. There's no way. Number one. Number two, to Miss Fred, do you have a last name?
Anderson.
Okay. to Mr. Anderson. To Mr. Anderson.
He's like the Pele of actuaries. Just a single name, Fred.
Kind of like Madonna or Sting or Cher or Greg or whatever.
Okay. Like I said, I can't believe what I'm hearing here, but this whole thing about solvency. So if we have PBR, we're going down. We're going down. They're all going under. So are you telling this committee, Mr. Anderson, that if we do this today, that Thrivent, Minnesota Life Securian, and Ameriprise are going to become insolvent? Because that's the way it sounds. Mr. Anderson? Well, not Mr. Rothman, Mr. Anderson. You're the actuary guy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, do you want me to answer the first question?
I think the first part was for the commissioner and the second part.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Mr. Anderson. Commissioner
Rothman. I'm happy to turn it over to
the reserves thing, that's a straw man argument, because there is no insurance company in this state that is going to let their reserves get low to put them in jeopardy of anything.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't disagree. In fact, when you look at the bigger picture, that brings into the issue of the usage of captives and how companies use captives with respect to the reserving practices to lower their reserves, which is a significant issue the NAIC is looking at as well. I'm happy to go into depth about that issue. But I think fundamentally what we see is that stock companies are driven by earnings. That's correct. They are, you know, out there by Standard & Poor's. But as stock companies, they're driven by earnings, and those earnings are important for them. And that is in part what puts the pressure on them to lower their reserves. It's an important factor to it. We're not saying that what will happen is doomsday, that tomorrow this is going to happen. We're saying, again, I have to go back to this, that it should be done in 2017. And then I'll turn it over to Mr. Anderson to answer the other question.
Mr. Anderson.
Okay, Mr. Chair. It's my first time here, so I want to make sure I get the protocol right.
You're doing great.
So to answer your second question, Minnesota has extremely strong life insurance companies. We're very lucky here. A possible dynamic is that other companies nationwide would be under-reserved without the strong regulatory framework that Minnesota has. And life insurance is all interconnected. With life insurance, you're selling a promise that could be 30, 40, 50 years down the road. All it takes is a couple of insolvencies, not necessarily by Minnesota companies, but by companies across the country. And it's going to cause problems for the Minnesota companies. So we have a Minnesota focus, but we also have a national focus at the NAIC and are kind of responsible for the national marketplace. And I agree with your statement that it's not like PBR is going to be adopted and all the Minnesota companies are going to go insolvent. But if there's PBR done wrong with, 60% or lower, 60% or more reserve reduction, it is going to lead to more weakly capitalized companies, and that could lead in the future towards just a weaker life insurance industry, which would impact Minnesota one way or the other.
And Ms. Rowan, to this point, did you want to? I saw Chairman Hoppe indicated he wanted to hear from you as well. Is that all right?
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A couple things. I think we would characterize the issue with LAHEDF as more of a hiccup than a major roadblock. It hasn't stopped other states from enacting and signing these bills. And we are very concerned about being left behind. To Commissioner Rothman's comment that somehow Wall Street is going to drive what happens here, actuaries, you can't make assumptions that aren't backed up by studies. I mean, they're required to sign a memorandum that says these are the reserves and here's why we calculated them. And plus, to Representative David's point is that nobody wants a weakly capitalized company. That doesn't benefit anyone. And so we remain concerned that the rest of the country goes forward and we don't. And that remains our concern. One of the things we would have liked to have offered if we had been able to have a dialogue with the department before sitting here is that maybe we could consider tying the effective date to what LAHEDF is working on. That way, if they resolve it, we can move forward and we're not left behind. And if they can't, then we can figure that out. But our big concern as the big domestic life insurers here is that we're getting left behind as the rest of the country goes forward.
Thank you. Representative Davids, you and I could probably, take over this conversation with a lot of questions, but I realize that. How about one more, and then we'll go to Representative Sanders?
One comment the commissioner made I'm a bit concerned about when he's concerned about stock companies, and they have to have earnings. Yeah, they have to have earnings, but solvency is more important to them than earnings. They're more concerned about solvency than earnings, so I think that's another straw man argument here. This is really embarrassing. You know, we've got a great Commerce Department, I don't understand why Brickwitty isn't a deputy yet, but we'll work on that. We've got a great Commerce Department, but on this issue, it's just bizarre land. I mean, we're right up there with American Samoa, and I love American Samoa. Fine territory. Great cookies from the Girl Scouts. American Samoas. Okay, so we are, you know, we're talking Minnesota Life, Thrivent, Ameriprise, Allianz, wonderful company. This is not Shifting Sands Mutual. These are companies that know what they're doing, and I'd argue they know a lot more about what they're doing than the department knows. And for us to sit here and say we're going to be right up there with American Samoa, that's embarrassing. That is, and I don't get embarrassed easily, obviously. But members, Pat, you know, we're hearing that, oh, we can't do it today, we have to wait till next year. Okay, so we're going to do it next year. Why don't we do it this year? There's this thing called the legislative session of January of 2017, and I'll tell you what will happen there. If there is a problem here, we're going to jump all over it for you. We don't want problems here. We want solvency. We want the same things you do. But to be prudent and cautious, and the 46 states are not being prudent and cautious, they've already passed them. And we're sitting out here, oh, let's go with Guam, or maybe the Virgin Islands. Why not? This is an embarrassment. Members, we need to pass this bill and get it enacted this year. And someday, Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you how I really feel about it.
Thank you, Representative Davids. When you feel strongly about something, you let us know, will you?
I will.
All right, good. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Commissioner, I have a couple questions for you and just maybe a little bit of further explanation. You have stated a major concern about the solvency if we move to PBR. You talked a lot about how you wanted to assure us that, you know, our home-based, very strong, very lucky to have Minnesota Life Insurance companies would not be disadvantaged if we don't do this. But I have a letter here from these CEOs that we just got done praising, saying that, you know, I mean, we've had the same reserve calculation for over 150 years, that this framework right-sizes reserves, that not only does it reduce some, but it raises or increases reserves in others. But then they also go on to say in the same letter that they're going to strengthen the solvency oversight for regulators such as your department, providing them with new tools to properly monitor life insurance reserve levels, and new annual reporting and review terms. Then they go on to say that they absolutely, if we don't pass it this session, they will be at a competitive disadvantage in the marketplace. Minnesota-based life insurers will be at a significant competitive disadvantage. Between this letter from these CEOs, we have 40 states that have done it, 6 that are pending, 2 that are committed to doing it this year. That's 48 through 2016, plus our CEOs of our company. Can you explain to me how basically they're all wrong and you guys are right?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair. First of all, Representative Davids, I did promote Brick Reedy to Assistant Commissioner, so not quite to the deputy level.
Chairman, we're making progress.
Representative, I did talk with and open a conversation and dialogue with the CEOs and the company representatives. I've even had conversations off one-on-one with them. From our analysis of those discussions and from the analysis of the actuaries that are looking at this, we don't see that the fundamental issue, we don't see it as a competitive disadvantage, and the reason is because things don't get implemented until 2017, and That's assuming all states adopt, or the 42 or majority adopt it, and there's 3 years of implementation. So what we're saying is, well, if it's passed in 2017, there's no reason to have a competitive, there won't be an issue of competitive disadvantage because, one, we're working with them to get up to speed, and two, it will happen. I don't want to, you know, speak for them, but fundamentally, I want to make sure that even those companies understand and see the modeling that's coming out of the valuation manual that shows reserves dropping on term life. As Mr. Anderson indicated, that discussion will be public in the next coming weeks. All of the companies will be there. I know at least one major company in the country does not share that perspective. So I think it's imperative that we, you know, continue the dialogue. We'll continue to work on it, and that's just our position. I think again, it's prudent and cautious. The prudent and cautious way to go is for Minnesota to do this in 2017.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you share who that is that you're just
not at this time, Mr. Chair? No,
Commissioner. Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So. Again, in this letter from these CEOs, they talk about that beginning on January 1st of 2017, as it's believed, and the numbers absolutely look like this is going to be passed this year, or will definitely be over that trigger of 42. They said that without PBR, Minnesota-based life insurers will not be able to offer term life products at these more affordable prices, whereas the companies that have adopted PBR will be able to. Are they incorrect?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll simply say the same thing. They're assuming that we don't adopt it. I'm saying we would come forward with a bill in 2017, and there's time for it to get done if it's fixed, and it's broken right now.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, we're not going to be in session on January 1st, 2017.
We're going to wait until January 2nd.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative, this is a three-year implementation process after 2017. Not every state is going to be up to speed with 3 years. Not every state is going to have the resources to do it. As a condition of the legislation, we believe, again, that we need the resources in Minnesota. It's not in this legislation. And there's time to do it. That's just our perspective.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up again on this. Commissioner, so the CEOs of our very lucky to have very awesome Minnesota life insurance companies state that beginning on January 1st, 2017, competing life insurers based in these states that have adopted PBR will be able to offer consumers term life insurance, an important form of life insurance that is in high demand at significantly lower prices. Without PBR, Minnesota-based life insurers will not be able to offer term life products at these more affordable prices. So, again, are they incorrect or are they correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason why companies will be able to charge under PBR lower amounts is because they'll be able to drop their reserves. They're able to drop the reserves. The prediction was, as we've testified, that reserves were going to be allowed to drop about 30 to 35%, which would be true. And if that's across the board and everybody's adopted, we're all on the same page, level playing field, no disadvantage to anybody. After everyone, even if after some states passes, the valuation manual was amended. The amendments created a major problem, which would now allow the reserves drop on average 60%, and in some scenarios down to near zero. So the companies that would be allowed to drop those reserves, oh, to anybody's advantage, it's going to disadvantage themselves, it's going to disadvantage the marketplace. And again, I believe as a matter of public policy, not only for Minnesota, but as for the rest of the country, that we all need to take a breath, we all need to let the Life Actuarial Task Force, do its work, get it right, get it fixed. Don't let this out on the streets until we come back, in particular in Minnesota, pass it in 2017.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Sanders? Representative Dean, I think you're the last one on the list, and then we'll see what we can do with this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not really sure how this gets to a question, and I'm just a simple guy. And my understanding of life insurance is that they really depend on the return that those reserves bring them as part of their business model in how economically they make life insurance work. And I guess my question is, I know that long time ago we didn't have all the algorithms and all the other types of things that we use now today. Every day you all have a device in your pocket, you know, that probably does more algorithms in 10 minutes than we could even begin to calculate if we used an algorithm. So my question is, if reserves do drop, you know, in the 50% range, what does that actually do to the whole economic investment model that insurance companies, life insurance companies were based on? Or has it gone so far away from that that my understanding of what life insurance was is really sort of archaic, like a caveman?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and Representative, generally you're correct, absolutely. And it's actually more complicated than that. The sophistication of the models and the way that it works is based on a lot of hedging, a lot of complex actuarial science. Fundamentally, though, the companies do take their capital. It is invested. In fact, one of the reasons why some companies have struggled during the Great Recession, because the interest rates did drop too low, that when they dropped so low, they were below the expectations of the companies and created challenges for them. Some companies are having trouble making the earnings they need off of interest to match the payments in the future over time to pay claims. And they're trying to make that up by, you can raise premiums and all of that. I don't know if that answers your question. Then maybe I can turn it over to Mr. Anderson to give more detail.
Mr. Anderson. Okay. Mr. Chair, I mean, there's a complex side to it, but the simple side is that the lower the amount of reserves, the less money there is available to pay claims. So that's the real concern on our part, is that with reserves lowering, you know, by 60 or more percent, there would just be that much lower amount of money to pay claims.
Representative Eden.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, but I'm really not talking about paying claims. I'm talking about a business model that is based on, you know, what you charge a consumer, what you're getting for a return on that reserves, that impacts that whole business model. And again, I know that things are a lot more complex than they were, you know, I don't want to say how long ago when I actually worked at Prudential Insurance Company. So, but I mean, my thing is, it would be great if we'd have an understanding of how PBR and how the new models are really laying forward something that can actually benefit not only life insurance companies but also consumers. And I'm inclined, which doesn't happen often, to be where Representative Davids is, that, you know, I mean, if this model is 100% sort of, or even 90% sort of, I'd like to keep the meadow between the two mountain ranges, you know, a little bit, you know, serene, so I don't owe you anything. But this whole notion of, you know, if as an industry moves and things change, you know, what does that really mean overall? And maybe I just don't understand how large of a portion that term life insurance might be for insurance companies. For all I know, it could be 4 or 5% versus 35 or 40%. So, you know, I mean, the impact of term life specifically might have a really, really small overall impact on the whole life insurance industry.
Thank you, Representative Dean. That sounded like more of a commentary than a question that needed to be addressed. Representative Davids has asked.
Very briefly.
We'll put this in your hands.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder if I could request that the Commissioner and the MFC folks, the industry folks, can open a dialogue and visit about some of these issues.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And I think that's where Chairman Hoppe started at the outset. His desire was to move it from this committee and before it got to civil law to perhaps see if some of those issues could be wrestled with. Commissioner, thank you. Mr. Anderson, thank you. Ms. Rowan, thank you. Chairman Hoppe, to your bill, any final?
members, thank you for a good discussion and excellent chairmanship. Mr. Anderson, it was nice to meet you. I didn't shake hands because I've got a cold. Members, I appreciate your time and your support, and ask to move it on to civil law, and we'll try to get the tweaks worked out between now and then.
I do think it's the finest discussion of PBR that's ever occurred in the history of this legislative body. With that, Chairman Hoppe renews his motion with respect to House File 3384 that it be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries on to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I believe that concludes the agenda, Mr. Chairman. Any announcements before we adjourn?
Happy Easter, everybody.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I would note that keeping with our spring break theme, Representative Sundin left quite a while ago carrying a little blue pail and a small shovel. I assume he's on his way to his spring break right now.
He's on his way to American Samoa, I think. With that, we stand adjourned.